Welcome to the Exalt Podcast. My name is Christopher Chagnon.
And I'm Sophia Hagalani-Albov. Today, we are joining you from that magic moment at the start of summer where you can actually stay up through the entire night in Helsinki. I worked late last night and I accidentally stayed up past sunrise.
Those are the dangers of this best time of the year. Well, that and the perfume of the flowers. But today, in this lovely long day, we are really lucky to have Arturo Escobar with us. I am super excited. He's an author who's impacted me a lot, that we taught about him in my classes. And, you know, I'm just, excited and nerding out a bit.
Yes, definitely. I'm also doing a little bit of academic fangirl, as I have used his writing extensively in my own writing as well. So this is a really exciting opportunity to get to talk with an author, thinker, scholar, philosopher who has had big impacts on both of us. So I don't want to take any more of the floor without further ado. Arturo, would you like to say hello to our listeners?
Yes, of course. Well, I want to start by thanking you, Sophia and Christopher, for the invitation and the Exalt program, Barry as well, and special salutation to people in Finland and Helsinki in particular. I've been there a number of times, including around the time of the solstice, the summer solstice, not the winter solstice. So, of course, I know what you're talking about. So it's great to be here with you.
Yes, thank you so much for joining us. So we're going to start very simple here. Would you like to tell our listeners who you are and what it is you do?
Yes, I think I can try to do that. I was actually thinking about that question and thinking by beginning to tell you that when you ask that question of anybody, actually, but even more so maybe of a person my age, I'm 69, it's not a simple question to answer, because it's a question, at least in my case, that I've been pondering about more and more again. I mean, I think there are moments in one's life when you ask that question of yourself always, from the time you're young to the time you're old, but I think they become particularly present and interesting when you have lived a number of decades. But I don't worry, I'm not going to burden you with my reflections on all of that, by no means. But just to tell you a little bit about, convey the complexity of the question, who am I as somebody who was born in Cali, Colombia, a Latin American, a man or a male, a white mestizo Latin American, a living being, an academic, an activist, scholar? Who am I in all of those registers? And I'll just mention a couple of things. Well, being a Latin American is very important. Being a Colombian, obviously, because of what's happening in Colombia right now, which is the worst crisis in Colombian history in 100 years, maybe. But being a Latin American, because Latin America has a particular sensibility, it's a particular set of problematics, emotions, and theoretical concerns and political concerns, of course. And I often say that I ended up being a very inorganic intellectual of two movements. The one is the feminist movement, because I've been a feminist since I was very young, since I entered college at least, and most of my main collaborators have been feminists, and also of a Black movement, because I ended up, I'm as white Latin America as it comes, but I ended up for the past 3 years almost working with Black groups and Black organizations in Colombia. And so that's all part of who I am. I would describe myself as well, more institutionally, as a researched activist, interested in questions of post-capitalism, post-capitalist transitions, post-extractivist transitions, which is, you know, very central to Exalt project, interested in ontological design, with a particular approach to design, interested in development and post-development, but mostly working nowadays, since my retirement from University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, working as an activist, as a writing intellectual activist, and affiliated with two PhD programs in Colombia. This is again on the institutional side, as an adjunct professor. I'm not regular faculty, I just do from time to time things with them. The first one is a PhD program on environmental sciences, And that's at Universidad del Valle in Cali, Colombia. It's my alma mater, a big public university. And the second one is at another public university in a different city. It's a PhD program in design and creation. And that's at the Universidad Caldas in Manizales, Colombia. And I am Professor Emeritus of Anthropology and Political Ecology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. So that's what I can say to begin our conversation in terms of that deceptively simple question of who I am and what I do.
Something that I always appreciated, and I guess something I think that can say into your background as well, if you don't mind talking about, is how did you get into this development, post-development, extractivism, post-extractivism sphere? Because from what I understand, that's not what you originally went to university for when you were heading out from secondary school. So I'm kind of curious if you wouldn't mind touching on that journey as well to help us kind of see.
That's true. And that's an excellent question again for me. I mean, when I was retiring here 3 years ago at Chapel Hill, they asked me to give a talk and I decided to give a bit of a retrospective talk. And I said I was something like I was going to summarize my intellectual life at least in just 5 slides. And that's what I did. It's kind of scary. You can summarize your life in a few slides and in half an hour, but that's actually the case. But you used the concept that I usually use is a journey. It's a journey. Sometimes I talk about my intellectual errancy. So moving through fields, which is also moving through frameworks and beginning. So I'm just going to mention the problem areas and the frameworks very briefly through which I moved over the past, I guess, 40 something years. So I started my first degree is in chemical engineering. So I was trying to be one of those extractivists and polluters and so forth. But I never actually worked as a chemical engineer. But I became interested in questions about hunger. That was in the late 70s when the hunger problem was beginning to explode on the world, on the global scene for the first time. And still from the technical scientific point of view. And then I shifted to the political economy of hunger. So realizing that hunger is a question not of just lack of food, but it's a political question, it's an economic question, it's a social question. And then that took me into the arena of development and the question of underdevelopment. So hunger as an aspect of so-called underdevelopment. And then questioning that very concept that Asia, Africa, and Latin America were underdeveloped and had to be developed by the rich countries. We're talking about the 70s and 80s. So that was the climax, if you will, of development interventions and development studies, the 70s and 80s. And then critiquing the idea of development through shifting from political economy of development, which only allowed me to show the connection between development and capitalism or underdevelopment and capitalism, to something more fundamental, that was showing the connection between development and hegemony, between development and culture, between development and, in the last instance, and the social production of Asia, Africa, and Latin America and developed. So that's when I shifted to post-structuralism. So the question by post-structuralism that post-structuralists began to ask was the question of how did development, has development worked as a discourse, as an articulation between knowledge and power that enabled rich countries and rich elite in the global south, in the third world, to systematically produce the realities of these countries in ways that kept that system going, that capitalist system going. And then from then on, from hunger to underdevelopment, to development, to post-development, and then to focus on strategies to challenge development by social movements. So that was all the work I did for about 20 years on social movements, mostly Latin American social movements, and that's in several books as well. edited volumes mostly, and then from there to the environmental dimension of both development, growth, and resistance to development and growth. And that was the field of political ecology. And finally, in the last 10 years or so, two interrelated concerns. The first one is the concern with what's happening with life and the earth as a whole. So something more, if you will, encompassing and more fundamental. And especially in two fields, in the field of political ontology, and we can talk a little bit about that later on if you wish. And second, in the field of design, and especially developing with a group of people. I'm not doing this any of this on my own. I've always believed and done collective work, that knowledge production is collective, even if you seemingly are doing it on your own. There is always a crucial collective aspect to all intellectual work. So working on those two fields of political ontology and design, especially around the question of relationality, of the radical interdependence of everything that exists as a foundation for life, as opposed to the separation of the ontological dualism of the modern way of being and doing and knowing. So I know there was a lot there, but that's sort of the trajectory, the journey of my intellectual errancy through fields, many different fields, you know, from science and engineering all the way to philosophy, in a way, political philosophy today, ecology, political ontology. And all of those fields are still somewhat present there, including the science itself, my interest in Maturana and Varela, for instance, in theories of self-organization, emergence and complexity in biology. All of that is part of this interest of mine that brings together science and social sciences and humanities. And the last part that I will say is that, especially in the last 25 years, since I started working on the Colombian Pacific with these Afro-Colombian organizations, that everything I do is a conversation between activist knowledges, knowledge produced by activists, and academic knowledges around issues of mutual interest and concern, whether it's globalization, of territorial defense, or resistance to capitalism, or thinking about alternative economies, or thinking about racism, sexism, the question of difference, and that in many ways, and I know I've said several times that this is the last thing that I'm going to say of now, but it's another aspect of this, that it has been throughout that journey from the 1970s until today, there have been three pressing concerns. The first one is the concern with social justice, understanding it and understanding the actions and the practice to address social inequality, social injustice. The second one is what is happening with difference, especially the suppression of difference, the marginalization of difference, the invisibilization of difference, and so forth. And the last one is the inadequacy of social theory, or the inadequacy of academic knowledge in general and social theory to deal with many of these questions. I'm not saying that academic theory, social theory is useless, by no means. It's very important, but it's insufficient to help us illuminate paths towards transitions to different ways of being, to a different mode of existence, which is what I think we need today. For that, we need a combination of other knowledges, from academic knowledge to activist knowledges to emotional knowledges, intuitive knowledges, all of that.
Thank you so much for sharing that journey with us and taking us, tracing us through your academic, both the problem areas and the frameworks that have gotten you to where you are currently working and thinking today. I want to hinge onto something that you said during that explanation, which is thinking about life and what's going on with the earth as a whole. And I was wondering if you could unpack that a little bit for us and give us some insight into what you mean by that.
Yes, definitely. And I think these are questions that for many people are becoming pressing for historical reasons, obviously. Climate change being one of them, but only one of them. Maybe let me start by mentioning the concept that has become important for me over the past 3 or 4 years. And this is the concept of terricidio or terricide, literally the killing of the earth. It's different from the Anthropocene, and I will explain in a moment why. So this concept has been proposed by the movement of indigenous women for buen vivir. That's the movement of indigenous women for good living, for collective well-being. That was started in the Gualmapu, which is the Mapuche territory in the southern part of the continent. And you can look on the internet for terricidio or terricide. There is a few things in English, most of it is in Spanish. But it's really an amazing concept and intervention by this group of indigenous women. And right now, actually, they are marching in Argentina to all the different indigenous nationalities, indigenous women, in particular marching on Buenos Aires to demand that the state finally begins to pay attention to terricide. And terricidio, they defined not only as the killing of the physical ecosystems, but also the what they call the spiritual ecosystems. And whatever the tangible and intangible, the perceptible and imperceptible. And as they say, and I will link it here with another concept from an indigenous group in Southwest Colombia, who is the NASA people. They have been advocating for what they call the liberation of Mother Earth, based on the premise, and the two concepts are very similar in many ways, based on the premise that the Earth has been enslaved, and as long as we, as she is enslaved, so are we, all humans and all living beings and all living beings on the planet. So they call on peoples from all over the world to contribute to the struggle against terricide for the liberation of Mother Earth. And obviously for developing different ways of being that are not terricidal. And that ways of being through which or that enable us to coexist with other humans and with all other entities on the planet in mutually enriching manners. So, and the premise again is that we no longer know how to live well as living beings. We're not living good lives as living entities, as living beings, and we have to relearn to do it. And again, these are concepts from indigenous peoples. And very important concepts. So that's, for me, that's the start today of how do we move, how do we transition to different ways of being, to different modes of existence that enable us to stop terricide, at least to lessen the most damaging dynamics and impacts of terricide. So there I link together three different concepts. The first one that originally comes, at least in Latin America, also from indigenous movements, is the concept of civilizational crisis. And I know you at the Exalt Project also work with this concept. Barry has been using the concept as well. So the civilizational crisis, what they suggest, what they mean by that is that the current crisis, the combined crisis of energy, climate, food, inequality, poverty, meaning, and so forth, is the crisis of a particular mode of existence. You can label it whatever way you want to label it. You know, Western capitalism, modern, colonial, racist, patriarchal, and so forth. And that as such, then it has to be responded to by movements, very pluralistic movements, towards civilizational transitions. There is not going to be just one big civilization that is waiting for us at the end of the road. We don't know what ways these paths are going to take, but the important thing for most of these groups is to embark on the journey of a significant ontological transformation, meaning by that a transformation in the ways in which we live, we do, we think, and we design the world in which we live. So that, to me, is an amazing project already, if we can call it that. Sometimes in Latin America now we use the concept of trajectory, traject. It doesn't work in English, because in Spanish you can say proyecto or trayecto. Project or trayecto is sort of the path. So we call it more a path than a project. So embark on that journey of civilizational transitions. So the first concept is civilizational crisis and terricide. The second concept is transitions, and we call it transitions to the pluriverse, and meaning by the pluriverse to away from this idea of a single world, a globalized capitalist world that has no place and no room for any other ways of worlding, any other way of constructing worlds and living life and designing meaningful existence. So there's the second concept. The third concept is that there is a principle that certainly many activists, and but also in the academy in different fields, is being proposed as an important principle, maybe the most important principle we can adopt today for the task of civilizational transitions or transitions to the pluriverse, which is the concept of relationality. That we need to go back to this idea of radical interdependence, the interdependence of everything that exists or between everything that exists as the foundation for life. That life is not based on the separation between humans and non-humans in particular, but that humans are in continuity with non-humans, that we do not, as humans, we do not exist unless everything that is non-human exists as well. So we are with non-humans all the time. And that radical interdependence is very important for beginning the task of rebuilding and reconstructing and redesigning and healing and caring for and sustaining those modes of existence that many people are envisioning today.
Thank you so much for that. That was beautifully explained and has my mind going in so many different directions. And actually, these three concepts tie back to something I wanted to ask you about that you'd mentioned before, in the three pressing concerns with, you know, social justice, the suppression of differences, sort of homogenization, and the inadequacy of academic theory to deal with it alone. And this is something that I would like to ask you a bit more about. How do we do that? Or how do you think we should do that? I'm not expecting you to have the only answer. In fact, I know that based on what you just said, you wouldn't have the only answer. There should be many different approaches. But what do you think? I really would love to dig into this more. It's such an important concept. You know, we very much believe that academia is great, but on its own, criticism for the sake of criticism and just speaking in an echo chamber isn't going to get anybody much of anywhere.
Yes. Well, to me, and maybe I'll mention here one of the concepts that I found very useful recently from theory, from social theory, from philosophy, and then move on to talking about how do we do this? And the concept is from Jamaican philosopher Sylvia Winter. She's not very well known. Sylvia with a Y, Winter with a Y as well. She's in her 90s already, still writing. And she's been influential in decolonial theory circles in Latin America. But beyond that, I'm not sure. But amazing, amazing thinker and writer. And one of her concepts is what she calls, she says that we are trapped within a mono-humanist vision of the human, or a mono-humanist view of the human. And what she means by that is that we're trapped within this notion of the human as liberal, secular, and bourgeois. It's a notion of the human that started to appear in the West around the time of the Renaissance. And she has a long, long, long explanation for that. And crystallized in the late 18th century, early 19th century, through the articulation of economic narratives and biological narratives around race. Economic narratives, especially homo economicus, economic man, competitive man, efficiency, utility maximization, all those different things, of microeconomic theory, and this questionable interpretation of Darwinian biology as focusing on the survival of the fittest, competition, and so forth. So she says this bioeconomic man, which is also liberal and secular, in particular became consolidated and became hegemonic, including increasingly in the rest of the world, out of the West to the rest of the world. And we are, to a greater or lesser extent, pretty much everybody is within this, the discursive confines of this man. Somewhat similar to Foucault's argument in The Order of Things, but I don't want to talk about that. We could talk about it if you want, but I prefer to mention Sylvia Winter's rendition of it. So the implication of this argument is that we need to move towards what she calls an ecumenical horizon for being, or ecumenical horizon of the human, which is going to be pluralistic, which is going to be many views of the human, which is going to be pluriversal. She doesn't use pluriversality, but that's the way in which we can also explain it. Where do we go from here? Then goes through understanding where we have been and how we got there. And that's one of the ways in which social theory helps us to understand that, to address that question of where have we been? How did we get here where we are today? As a prelude, as a precondition, because we have to go through that. We have to go through that figure of man in order to get outside of that man, modern man, to other configurations of the human. So that's her argument. So what does that mean in concrete terms? And I think we begin to see sort of the multiple ways in which people in different parts of the world engage with that dominant hegemonic understanding of the human when they resist particular realizations of that human, whether it is growth or extractivism or capitalism or white capitalist patriarchy or what have you, that people engage with that dominant notion of the human and try to undermine it when they engage in actions, in what we call transformative alternatives. Alternatives in the field of water or food sovereignty, urban gardens, commons, degrowth, struggles against extractive operations in the global south or in the global north as well, because they're happening in the north as well. All of these acts of resistance, many of them seem to, in one way or another, undermine and resist that world that has been designed out of that particular understanding of the human, which is also anthropocentric, is patriarchal, et cetera, et cetera. So what I've been doing in the last couple of years, 2 or 3 years, I've been focusing on what I call six axes or strategies for transitions. And I'm going to just mention them very briefly and maybe refer those who are listening to the special issue of globalizations, which is on, it's on civilization. So I can't remember exactly the title, but I have an article for that special issue that outlines and describes one of these six areas. And the six areas are the following. So the basic idea is that for each one of these six areas, we can think about what kinds of actions are being already been done by different groups of people in the world, or what can we do wherever we are, whether in Helsinki or in Dakar or in the Brazilian rainforest or what have you. So, and these six areas overlap and interact with each other. There is no order of priority among them. You can enter into any one of these areas and begin to think about what it means, and then you will find your way into the other areas. So they are the following. The first one is the recommunalization of social life, meaning by that, to try to make again the making of life and life itself more communal. The reason is simple, because globalization has been, in many ways, a war against everything that is collective and communal. Globalization has been the project to impose the cultural regime of the individual, the ontology of the individual, separate from community, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So recommunalizing social life, rebuilding the links of interdependence that constitutes the communities, places, and bodies that we are, is one of these axes, one of the most important ones. The second one is probably more clear to most people, is the relocalization of productive activities, economic activities, cultural activities. Food is one of the most important areas, and there's a lot of emphasis today on relocalizing food production and food sovereignty. COVID also brought that, the importance of local food, to the fore. But relocalizing energy, relocalizing healing, relocalizing many things. The third one is the strengthening of local autonomies as forms of direct democracy. So only if we regain the autonomy over our own life-making practices, our own political decisions, at least a measure of that autonomy, will we be able to engage in meaningful action against this idea and this realization of a single world, globalized, capitalist, neoliberal, and so forth. The fourth one is something that Latin American feminists always emphasize, which is the simultaneous depatriarchalization, decolonization, and de-racialization of social relations. So patriarchy is the most enduring ontology, the most enduring way of being, model of life. It's been around for 6,000 years easily. And in many ways, patriarchy is at the root of the ontology of separation, because patriarchy is an ontology that emphasizes of privileges, hierarchies, control, appropriation, and domination, negation of the other, and in the last instance, violence and war. So that's, in many ways, patriarchy is at the basis of this tremendously complex assemblage that is global domination today, which is imbricated with capitalism, with racism, with colonialism, and so forth, anthropocentrism, and so forth. So depatriarchalization, de-racialization, and decolonization of social relations. The fifth one is the integration, the reintegration with Mother Earth, or with Pachamama, with Gaia. And that's also central. So that means moving away from this anthropocentric ways of being towards Earth-centered, and we can call it ecocentric, biocentric, geocentric, non-terricidal ways of being. And the sixth one is the bringing together, the weaving together of transformative alternatives. How do we meshwork these transformative alternatives with each other so as to create effects that go beyond each one of them? Synergistic effects and synergistic conversations for action among transformative alternatives.
Wow, that is so much to think about. I'm wondering if it would be possible if you were able to kind of pull that together into what that looks like as a situated example, like on the ground, like what does this actually look like in practice?
Yes. I mean, in some sense, that's a very difficult question to answer, but it's also a very easy question to answer. So let me start by telling you about an initiative in which I'm involved, and I'm sure some people in Finland are, some of them are aware of it, which is the Global Tapestry of Alternatives. Global Tapestry of Alternatives, GTA. You can find it in the internet easily. And the idea of the GTA, which has a main anchor in India, in South Asia, but especially India, and another one in especially Mexico and Colombia. And one of the main people behind the GTA is Ashish Kothari. You probably know who Ashish is, Gustavo Esteva and Gustavo Esteva. But there's a group of people from all over the world, is precisely this idea of thinking about the convergences among transformative alternatives. And we define transformative alternatives or radical alternatives as those that are breaking with the existing global capitalist system and taking new paths based on ideas of sufficiency and autonomy and conviviality and respect of the earth and ecological democracy and so forth. So if you go on the website, you find a very good conceptualization of this vision and project. You will also find that we have been doing a series of webinars over the past year and a half, I believe, that we started with the first one, maybe a year, focus on small and unknown cases where some of these things that I was talking about, some of these strategies have been implemented in different parts of the world, in South Asia, in Latin America, in Europe itself, in Canada, for instance, by a group of women in the Ecuadorian Amazon, or by a group of workers in the US. So it doesn't have to be rural. We usually tend to think about indigenous people, so rural peasants and so forth. No, this is happening worldwide. Worldwide, people are trying to heal and create and defend the web of life and reweave that web of life in different ways. So that's one thing that I can point you to that is very concrete. The second is that obviously there are exemplary cases, what we can call really amazing examples, from, you know, the Zapatista in Chiapas that had been in the process already by 20 years of building autonomous communities and regaining autonomy over healing and learning and dwelling and feeding themselves and so forth under very difficult conditions. They are very poor communities. They continue to be poor. So they are not into economic development. They are into more self-sufficiency and solidarity and so forth. One of the groups that you will find in the GTA website, one of the main groups in India is something called, I'm not remembering the name too well, Vikalp Sangam, I think. You'll find it there easily. It starts with V as in Victor, V-I, BIKLP, and which is an articulation and a network of many of these alternatives, especially by poor people in India, by Dalits and Adivasi and so forth, which is very strong and involves thousands and thousands of people. In Mexico also, there's an amazing experience in Cheran, Mexico, of entire communities that decided to take control over their own lives again from narcos and the state and corporations, and have been developing this amazing set of new experiences and collective ways of dealing with these problems, the problems facing them. Obviously, the Rojava struggle by women, especially the feminist struggles in Rojava, is very inspirational in this respect as well. There are some exemplary cases, but there are also multiple small cases in many different parts of the world. I think in Europe, so many things that are associated with commons and commoning, with transition and transition towns, with degrowth, with rewilding, with mapping again Europe's biodiversity and species. There are so many interesting things going on at that level that could be connected to this. Now, the question, and this is the question, are they moving in the right direction, so to speak? How do we know that they are not being functional to this global capitalist monster that seems to swallow everything? How do we know that they won't be reabsorbed by a new wave of delocalizing globalization that just takes those local experiments and reglobalizes them in different ways? And all of those risks are real. But I think people are better and better every day at coming up with criteria to know whether their experiments, because sometimes they are experiments, whether their projects, their initiatives, the transformative alternatives are susceptible of being reappropriated or not. And maybe I can end with this by suggesting that there are two open questions today that to me are very important in both social activist practice and in social theory. And the first question is, what is a transformative alternative? What is a radical alternative? How do we characterize radical alternative? Especially those that really challenge in significant ways. Because of what they do, they don't even have to be actively opposed to capitalism or what have you. Because of what they do constructively and positively on the ground. So what is a radical transformative alternative? And again, in the GTA, we have come up with a conceptualization of that. That is up for everybody to discuss. And the second one, which we don't know well how to answer anymore, is what is social change? What is what we used to call systemic change? You know, in the climate movement, people say system change, not climate change. Remember that? And that's very important. But what is system change? Is that still a good question even? What is the system? Do we understand well what the system is? Once we give up the answers to that question by either liberal theory that says that social change is done by individuals and institutions and the reform of legislation, et cetera, through politicians, or the conventional Marxist answer to that question, that social change is done by development of class consciousness and eventually the proletarian revolution, et cetera. And knowing what we learn from post-structuralism, that the role of discourse and power is important in how we think about social change, but it's not sufficient, then what becomes of social change? What is our current understanding of how social change happens? And I think this is still a question that we need to be thinking more about.
Absolutely. That is a lot of amazing food for thought. I mean, I could go off on a lot of different questions and a lot of different ideas popping into my head here, but I know that we are getting towards the end of our time. We know that you have to get back to the rest of your day. So at the end of every episode, we like to ask our guests the question.
Chris, what's the question?
The question.
The question is, for our listeners at home, you've talked so much about these amazing concepts and approaches of radical alternatives. There's so much here. But what can somebody, your average person listening to this at home, do? What can you advise to them? Like, it could be going out, it could be changing something in their lives, it could be reading about something, but what's a concrete step that I could wake up tomorrow and do to make a difference?
Okay, well, again, that's not an easy question to answer, but I'd like to say a couple of things, maybe one that for most people is going to be counterintuitive, and that is the following, which is that in order to really figure out what we can do as individuals, the first thing we really need to do is to stop thinking we are individuals, is to see ourselves as much more than ourselves. If we really think deeply and internalize the insights of radical interdependence, we realize that there are no individuals. And many people in the world know that. Certain indigenous peoples in the world live without a notion of the individual as we in the West know it. And this is a well-known concept in anthropology. If people who have done ethnographic research in Melanesia, in the Amazon, in the Peruvian Andes, what have you, find that the notion of the individual as we know it in the West doesn't exist. People are always persons in relation to land, to the territory, to the ancestors, to the spirits, to each other, to history. So thinking deeply about de-individualizing ourselves is a very important step. And there are tools for doing that. You know, meditation is one of them, especially Buddhist meditation. Buddhism is a philosophy of mind, basically, that begins with the affirmation and has as one of its main affirmations the fact that the self as we know it, as we believe we know it, doesn't exist. Things do not have intrinsic existence in and of themselves. Everything is mutually produced, mutually constituted. So think deeply about what that means. How do we de-individualize ourselves? Which means, how do we reconnect with others, with other living beings, with the natural world, in such a way that we become inseparable with the rest of the universe? Because that's what it is in the last instance. We are all in this sort of mesh of life together. So very difficult to realize, to really get at that realization. I could say much more about that, but I'll leave it there. And then what do you do after that? What do you do after you begin to reconnect and engage? Then you develop a practice. You go beyond sort of the intellectual thinking and you engage in a practice with others, humans and non-humans, as we say today. And in a practice that will inevitably lead the way towards recommunalizing, relocalizing, depatriarchalizing our own lives, building more local autonomies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a journey. It's an ontological transformation from being individuals to being persons in relation always, from being disconnected to be reconnected, from feeling disempowered to do anything because this system disempowers us to do anything as individuals, other than trying to be successful in market terms and individual terms, to really come up with very good ideas about what makes sense to do in terms of the earth and life, of, as you know, my own definition of this activist practice today, which could be a definition for designing as well, is a praxis for healing and caring the web of life, or the web of interdependence that constitutes the bodies, places, and communities that we are and in which we exist. So that's what I would say. And then you start finding out about these exciting alternatives close to you to contribute to reweaving community close to you and reweaving local economies, local food, etc. Live more autonomously, not so dependent. There's a concept that we came up recently with, which is the concept of outsourcing the making of life. most of us outsource the making of life. We don't grow our own food. We don't sew our own clothes. We don't learn our own knowledge. We don't heal our own bodies. We don't do any of that. Experts do that for us. That's outsourcing the making of life. So how do we begin to gain a tiny bit of autonomy of some of those processes? And that's a way to reconnect as well. I think that's what I would say. Okay?
That was absolutely fantastic.
Great.
I mean, like not yeah, I mean, not just good, great. That was truly fantastic. I mean,
I'm glad you liked it.
That was an answer to the question on both a practical and spiritual level.
Mm-hmm. That's true too.
I could ask about a million more questions, but unfortunately, we're going to have to say goodbye for today. But I know for me, this has been just a spectacularly inspiring conversation, and I really appreciate your time, and I'm sure that our listeners out there are really going to enjoy it. Is there anything that you would like me to put down in the show notes for them? For example, a key reading or something like that, that you would like the listeners to be able to access?
The link to the GTA, I think that would be great.
Wonderful. Great. We'll definitely make sure to do that.
Arturo, thank you so much for coming on. It really has been so much of a feast for thought and as well for the spirit. It's really a lot of great things to ponder and also a lot of deep feelings coming out of it. So I can't say how grateful I am to have you on here. And I hope that we might be able to talk with you again in the future.
Thanks so much, Chris and Sophia, again, for the wonderful interview and everybody there in the project.
A huge thank you to Arturo Escobar for coming on and having that fascinating, enlightening, and enriching conversation. Please join us next month when we will be talking with Mira Kakkonen. From the short nights and sweet blooms of Helsinki, Finland, I am Christopher Shagnon. On behalf of Sophia Hagelani-Albov, thanks for listening, stay safe, and we'll catch you next time.